All right, it's time for another edition of Roughing the Passer podcast on Mondays. I'm Pete Prisco, joined by the viral man himself, Brady Quinn.
It makes it sound like I've got a bunch of STDs or something.
Well, Let's hope you don't.
No, I'm clean. I've got a clean bill of health.
You went viral last week because you made comments, and Pat Kerwin led you right into that. Pat, you led him right into that last week, and he went viral.
You're not driving a wedge between me and Brady. That was a nice shot at trying to. That's not happening.
Well, yeah, because you guys team up on me. It's not fair. I got to try and do something here to drive a wedge
between. Get a fourth guy. See if you can find a friend.
No, that was actually really good. We had a nice conversation about that last week, about HGH, and Brady thought that the majority of it, not the majority, but the glut of injuries was maybe caused by HGH use in the NFL. And you said 40% of players you thought were using HGH. And
I'm not saying 40% are using HGH. I think there could be something that's not allowed or that's banned. And look, all the conversation was about is if you're not saying it's about the footwear, right? Because we've seen so many Achilles, so many ACLs, knee injuries, lower body extremity injuries. And then Pat brought in the fact that torn pecs, torn biceps, which obviously doesn't include footwear, and saying the field surface too, the synthetic turf or grass, if it's not as a result of that, and clearly a pec or bicep wouldn't be, then you have to draw some other conclusion. So the conclusion I'm trying to draw is the fact that there must be something that these players then are putting inside their bodies to obviously cause them to have some of these soft tissue injuries that we've seen an uptick in this year. And as I said before, I'll stand behind it. Quarterback apologist is what you call me. I'm not apologizing for what I said because it's a logical conclusion that I'm drawing to it based on the fact of what we're seeing right now. And I'm not calling anyone out. I'm not trying to be a whistleblower to this. I think it's something that the NFL's known for quite some time, Pat, that this kind of stuff goes on. Players want to try to find an edge, and they're willing to do so because the punishment isn't that so much that it would deter you from doing it, because we talked about it last week. 4-game suspension, that's it? Yeah, if I'm trying to get a huge money contract with as much as players are making nowadays, I think there's other players who would take that risk if they're in a position where it would help them. For a quarterback, it doesn't help at all.
In this league as long as they can.
Yeah, and that's one of the keys too for an older player in particular, trying to do something like that to be able to continue making the type of money you're making, because once you're out, you don't make that same type of money again.
Well, it went a lot of places. It went a lot of places. Huffington Post, Deadspin, everywhere. Any backlash in your direction from peers, players you played with, anybody in the league?
It was interesting. Like, no players, anyone I played with, anything like that, or even peers. You had kind of mentioned, like, Sean O'Hara or someone that said something like that.
Sean O'Hara questioned what you were saying. I don't know exactly how he did it, but he did it on a show. Gottlieb show, I think it was.
Okay, which is interesting considering how skinny he looks from when he played when he did.
And wow!
Every lineman loses weight for the most part once they're done playing. There's no chance that he was on that. I just think a lot of people kind of looked at the quote, and the problem was when I woke up the next day, it's my quote, and then it's sitting with a picture of Le'Veon Bell, which not once do I ever say anything about Le'Veon Bell or even mention his name, yet that's the conclusion that people draw because that's the image that people want to paint based on the quote, and that's just not the case.
Well, one of his contentions was you don't have any idea what goes on with guys in the locker room. Not you, but any other player doesn't know what any other player is really doing in the locker room.
No player knows what any player is doing, because even if they are, you'd see sometimes guys would come back after the offseason, and if they're a P-squad guy the year before, all of a sudden they look gigantic. They're more powerful off the ball, and you're going, this guy put on 30 pounds. Like, this wasn't like a late growing spurt. There's something else going on there.
See, Pat, for me, I 100% believe what Brady said. I've always been a believer in that about that number. I thought that was right. How'd you take it when he said that with the number, now that you've had a little week to digest it?
Well, the number is always debatable, and it's speculative, to say the least. I do think that there's an awful lot of pressure on players to look for every competitive edge they can find in order to stay in this league as long as they can. And so that will lead a number of them. So older players are looking for recovery methods, and a lot of people believe that the recovery rates are a lot faster. We can look at some of the more unusual recovery rates from some ridiculous injuries where guys are back in 6 months where everyone thought he'd be out for a year minimum. But I want to bring this up because after this podcast went out last week, I got a phone call from a general manager, and he said, and I don't talk to him a lot. We wave hello at the Senior Bowl and that kind of thing, and once in a while talk about things. But he said, look, I was listening to your podcast, And he was specifically interested in discussing with me and enlightening me in the area of the Achilles injuries. So I said, well, what do you got? He goes, we've had a number of them ourselves over the years, and we have done a lot of research on the Achilles injuries internally first. So are we doing the right things? Are we prepping these guys, et cetera? But we've also reached out to many, many of the guys who've had Achilles injuries that are NFL players over the years. We've collected a lot of data. And he goes, it's for us, we've drawn the conclusion it's the shoes for that injury. And he said, and he believed the Nike shoe specifically had been worn by 90% of the guys who had Achilles injuries. And he also said that a lot of the guys put some extra things inside the shoes because they're so damn uncomfortable. And he didn't know that the company felt liable for the shoe once those guys did that. He said, look, I'm just trying to point you in a direction that you should spend your research time on, and it's worth you going after it. I'm not going to give you our report. I'm just telling you, head down that trail, and you're going to come to some conclusions that are going to help you understand the Achilles world that the NFL is facing. So I asked the doctor right away after that. He said, well, you know, he knew, and it was amazing because I said, they're on the rise, aren't they? We have more this year than later. He goes, well, no. And he knew the Achilles numbers off the top of his head, which was kind of alarming to me that he was monitoring it himself without admitting to me he was. He also said there's a committee in the league, right? We all know an ankle and foot committee. And he said, you need to go in front of those guys. You need to go invite them to your podcast. Get someone to come in and talk to you about what's going on. But they clearly know, I won't call it an epidemic, that's not fair, but they know there's a rise in this, and they're leaning towards the footwear as the number one culprit in it. And so anyway, I'm going to do more work on it. It might take a few months, but it was kind of this GM to call and say, hey, I heard you guys. It was really interesting. You're scratching the surface of something that's pretty big.
And Brady, you've broached this subject before about the footwear. This is something that you brought up, I think, maybe one of our first podcasts, that they got to look closer to the footwear.
Yeah, and it's because I had issues when I was wearing a particular brand and foot problems. Not only did I have tendonitis in my Achilles tendon, which was probably a result of just dropping back in general, but of all the time I did it in college with a certain brand, and then all of a sudden I started dropping back in the NFL and practicing and all that, I started having more issues with my Achilles in my right back leg, because that's your plant leg when you drop back. Yep. And I never had that issue before in college, but all of a sudden I had it, you know, right away in the NFL as a rookie and all that.
Were you forced to wear a certain shoe in the NFL?
Well, I wasn't forced. I mean, signed a contract.
So isn't that ultimately on the player to decide?
Yeah, and that's why I'm not gonna ever complain about anything, because I chose to wear the shoe, right? I chose to represent them. But at the same time, if we're trying to draw a conclusion of why these injuries are happening, I think you have to look at it. And right now, if you think about a business model, why would you want your shoe to be so durable that you only need one pair a season? You want to sell more shoes, so you want them lighter. You want them cool and flashy, but you don't want them to be necessarily that durable. As long as they're able to get by, you wouldn't have to force people to go back out, buy more shoes, throw out another cool one for the playoffs that's got a completely different design or completely different, you know, way of expressing your logo. That way it creates more interest around having the same plain thing every single week.
What shoes did you wear at Notre Dame?
Adidas.
What contract did you have in the NFL?
And we're not Nike.
So we're not throwing a blanket indictment of Nike shoes all across the board, but you felt more comfortable in the shoes you wore. You were giving at Notre Dame. They gave you. They had a contract with Adidas, so you wore Adidas. You felt more comfortable in the Adidas than the ones you were being paid to wear.
But let me say this as a player too. I had the same exact pair from my freshman year to senior year of Adidas at Notre Dame, which isn't cool. It's not fun when you're wearing the same exact type of style of shoe and all that. I happened to like it, but it was also the best they had to offer. But I also never had any foot issues with it. I got in the NFL. I had a Liz Frank injury. Although that was as a result, you can make a case as far as contact. I had another high ankle sprain right away when I got into, and again, that I wouldn't necessarily say was a result of contact. It was more movement in the way the foot, you know, planted and all that. And then I talked about the Achilles thing that I kind of always had to deal with, having like tendonitis in it. But that was more, I think, as a result of just the volume. You know, when you're in college, you kind of have, you know, your downtime. It's your downtime because you have studies and all that. In the NFL, when I wasn't watching film, I was practicing my craft, trying to perfect my craft. So I don't even want to necessarily draw a conclusion to it based on the footwear for like my Achilles being tight and bothering me and all that.
Okay, you're an NFL player. You signed a contract with Nike. Do they come fit you with a shoe that's made specifically for your foot? You know, they have running stores where they fit your feet. They put you, they test your gait.
Yeah, you go, you go, and you basically have a certain style of shoe for you, right? They help mold around your foot and all that, but that doesn't, like, it doesn't stray so far away from what everyone else is wearing in the NFL too, right? As far as thickness and protection and how much the shoe bends or how wide the toe box is. Like, they'll make some variations, but they're not making the shoe so drastically different that it's your own shoe like your Michael Jordan.
Right. And Pat, when I was out in Arizona talking to Charles Bentley, he actually has a contract with Nike to create big man shoes. And by that, his whole point was, the shoe foot is so much different for a big, giant foot, the big guy, than it is for maybe a wide receiver or a corner. So he's developing a line of big man shoes because the support isn't there for the big guys. Well, it sounds like they need to go back and reevaluate the way they're doing. Everybody needs to reevaluate that we're doing the cleats for everybody now.
Well, I don't really have a vested interest for or against Nike. Couldn't care less. All I was told was they try to notify or get in touch with every person who's had an Achilles tear and ask them what they were wearing. So that's a piece of information. And if 90% of the guys say they had on a Nike shoe, then it's time to investigate the shoe. I also don't think you can look at an Achilles injury strictly from a shoe. You've got to look at the feel surface. You know, so I asked for that information as well. You know, is there a difference between grass feels? Is the difference between synthetic feels, indoor, outdoor? You know, are you looking at all those things? The one thing I will say is I do think that the clubs should be way more involved with the legislation of shoe wear for the players. I just think, and this is not just about Achilles, but in the course of this discussion I was having, we got into a whole other area of how the receivers are wearing basically slippers. They'll do anything for what they think is going to enhance speed, and they'll take risks. And I said, the club should be more involved with that. They should not let them do that. You're not going to let a guy play without shoulder pads because he wants to be faster. So why are you letting him wear shoes that you hold your breath wondering if he's going to get hurt in? So, I mean, we can get on to other great football topics.
Yeah,
but
yeah, one thing about that, though. Remember, Pat,
up with what happened.
The receivers started taking the pads out of the pads to become out of the pants to become faster, and they made them put them back in. And so, yeah, to your point, that makes a lot of sense because they made them put the pads back in to be safer. So maybe they need to reevaluate the footwear. And
if
what
we have
the receiver,
a foot and ankle committee, what does that tell you?
Right.
Why would they have a committee?
And we saw Anthony Hitchens last night or Sunday night in the Dallas game look like he might have even suffered an Achilles tendon.
Yeah, I mean, but also in the Dallas game, you looked at Dez Bryant. They actually did a shot of his shoes. He's wearing a different shoe than what he used to wear, in part because they had to build orthotics. And then Nike did help him to build a little bit wider shoebox and a little more durable shoe. And I'll say this just to kind of cap off this conversation. 2014, I was with the Miami Dolphins in training camp. The shoe pair that I decided to wear in the very first time, really my only game action, they let me, you know, go in at the end of a game in garbage time. It was offensive lineman shoes because they were more durable. They had a wider toe box, and they allowed me to wear orthotics, which I felt gave me better protection for my feet in case I did get rolled up on or anything happened. So I actually was wearing a pair of O-line shoes at the end of my career because at that point I felt like that was what was most durable and really what felt most comfortable once I was able to drop back in the pocket.
You know what they need to do? Go back to Rydell's and Spot Belt. Remember those, Pat?
Oh, gosh, yes. Now, these young guys, they wouldn't wear those heavy clunkers.
No, they wouldn't,
but
those are actually good cleats.
The Liz Frank doctors, I talk to those guys. We have a couple that join our show on a weekly basis, and they feel like the Liz Frank injuries are coming from what they call soft soles that are too bendable, that the sole needs to be firmer if you want to be involved with preventing a Liz Frank. So.
Yeah, and you see those Nike Freeze and those sorts of brands. I mean, those are as bendy and mobile as they get. There's even, and I actually did this. I kind of fell into this trap. I had a Liz Frank injury, and I was like, all right, how do I strengthen my foot? What can I do? And people kept talking about barefoot running and these Vibram bare five finger toes and all this, so you get dexterity. And I tried using them and all that. And I was and that really didn't help. It didn't do anything. And eventually I talked to enough foot doctors who basically said, look, your foot wasn't designed to be able to run without cushioning, right? Like, unless you have, for generations, you know, you're in your genetic code. They've done that. He's like, your family is not. So you're not, you know, prone to necessarily, you know, wear shoes like that and deal with it and handle it. Like for the sport of football, you need padding. You need some sort of protection for your foot.
Tape it up and get in the damn game, Quinn. Come on. Tape it up.
Old Prisco.
Here he comes again. Here comes Newt Rockne, Brady.
Yeah. He really wants Come to be on, the Pat, one to go viral. Just say something controversial.
I don't know what Pat's talking about. He was Newt Rockne's general manager back in the day.
And you were the size of an offensive guard back then. So,
all right, let's move on to some football. There was an interesting lot of developments on Sunday. And first and foremost, we got to start with Aaron Rodgers and the Green Bay Packers. Two consecutive losses on the road. Now, to two good teams. Both those teams were undefeated when they lost to them. But is there reason for concern in Green Bay? Pat, I'll start with you.
Yeah, there is reason for concern if the ultimate goal, the ultimate realistic goal, is winning a Super Bowl. If you're just a team that's trying to get through the season and hope to be 8-8, well, there's no concern. But if your expectations, and I think legitimately to get to the Super Bowl, if you're the Packers, yeah, there's concern. There's concern on a couple of areas. Well, where are his targets? Are his receivers? We finally figured out the loss of Jordy Nelson has to be accepted as a real problem. We can debate that. Is the defense really a shell of what it has to be? Can they really stop the run? You know, they got some injuries, but so I don't know right now. If I look at them and I pick them to go to the Super Bowl, I don't know if I feel good about them being able to reach that goal with the limitations I just cited.
Pat, I don't know how good I feel about that either, considering they're not as good of a road team as they are a home team. Green Bay Packers at home, almost untouchable, right? But then you look at them on the road, and they just don't play quite as well. I don't know if they feed off the crowd or the environment, but overall they seem to play much better football, and it seems like the NFC is going to have to run through Carolina, who's another team that plays very well at home.
But they're good at home as they're structured right now. If you're Seattle, Arizona, even Green Bay again, whoever, you know, Dallas if they got it right, or whoever wins the, are you that concerned about going to Carolina to play them in the postseason? In other words, when Seattle was at their best, that was a major concern to go to Seattle and play them. When Green Bay's at their best, it's a major concern to go to Lambeau and play them. Do you guys get that same sense from Carolina?
Well, I know why you ask, and it's a legitimate question, but there are dimensions to that team that can cause anyone in the NFL problems. Number one, that defense. Whether you want to break down the pass rush, they're going to get Charles Johnson back soon. The linebackers are unique players. They can line up on any you can throw 11 personnel at them. They don't need to sub. They can do all that. They're better in the secondary than everyone thought. Pina Tillman still has some life to him to go along with maybe the best young corner in the game, Josh. So the defense can cause problems for anybody. And Cam Newton's a problem all the time because he breaks down what your defense is based on. No one wants to assign players to the quarterback. And not only is that guy a threat, they have designed a power running game for him. So you got to deal with all that. Here's the only place I think if I was a Panther fan, I'd worry. If you're down two scores in the fourth quarter, I said this last week, I don't know that, and running isn't allowed because there's not enough time on the clock, and he has to be just a thrower. I don't know about that, but the other things I think are so strong, they're going to be a problem for everyone.
Yeah, Pat, and they don't find themselves in that position very often because they do play from ahead for the most part with the style of offense they play combined with that defensive scheme. And I guess I looked at that question more as like the environment. And no, I don't think teams...
Not so much the environment, the team, the way it's built... To me.
Well, because I'll put it this way. When you posed the question, I was thinking, my head? Yeah, I'm more concerned with the crowd noise and things that happen at the Clink up in Seattle as opposed to Carolina,
yeah,
or Green Bay for that
course.
Matter, especially with the addition they had last year, and even Arizona. Arizona, who's you know, sellout crowd or whatever the record is, they've actually, you know, they've been more impressive than you think, and it's a bit, you know, it's a little louder in Arizona than most people give them credit. I would say Carolina's the one place that really, when I think of those four teams, is the least scary to want to, you know, go into and have to deal with from just a crowd noise perspective in the environment.
But we all think Green Bay is going to get it going eventually, right? I mean, I think Mike McCarthy needs to take over play calling duties again. I don't know if he will, but I think they'll get it cranked up.
I don't know. Devin Funchess has had a pretty solid, you know, outing. He's kind of trying to develop into that big play wide receiver downfield
for Carolina.
Philly Brown was all right too. I mean, he's a speedster. I don't know. Ted Ginn needs to catch the football, and then that would help. I mean, but he's impressive as it is in the return game, which is another element we haven't talked about. He adds that different element to that field position battle that gets overlooked by everyone. But Carolina also does a nice job with the field position battle because of their defense, because of special teams.
All right. There was a hit in the Minnesota-St. Louis game. Teddy Bridgewater, the quarterback, took a little shot elbow to the head from LaMarcus Joyner. Mike Zimmer, who might be one of the feistiest coaches in the NFL, really got after the Rams after the game. He didn't exactly run over and shake Jeff Fisher's hands. It was kind of a brush by. He had some not so nice words for Greg Williams, said, you know who he is, you know what he was involved in. What was your take on the hit, Pat?
It was disgusting, and the league has cleared up why you can't do that. And it's not like the slide. It's not like Teddy started the slide real late. Brady knows what I mean by that. And then now the guy was already launched to make a tackle, and now they meet. No, the slide was on, and he had time to, in my opinion, to divert that, and he didn't. And it looked like he felt like, and I think the fine's going to be big. But we're asking these quarterbacks to put themselves in a defenseless position, the slide, to protect them. So if you want to start jeopardizing that by attacking the slide, then you've really bastardized what protecting this guy's all about. So I hope the fine's huge, and I get why Zim, he went right past Jeff on the field there at the end of the game. And I saw Jeff whip his head back, kind of like, what the heck? Hopefully they'll work their thing out, but I hope it's a big fine.
You know, let me play devil's advocate just for a second as a player, because I think most people would think that I would side with the quarterback in this instance, but there's a couple things. The call in general is basically an intent call, which I think is hard for an official to make what the intent of Joyner was, because when I watch it in real time, yeah, it looks like what they call a targeting, if you're talking about the college football game, meaning that a player was going after a defensive player above or trying to hit the neck or head area. And this particular case, yes, it looked like Teddy Bridgewater was going to slide, but he did kind of make a subtle juke move. And I saw in another game, I think it was actually Andrew Luck, who made it seem as if he was going to go down to slide and then kind of popped out of it quick. So the defenders are in a catch 22. You know, they're damned if they do, they're damned if they don't try to make a play on him. And at that last second, when I slowed it down, I actually argued with another former player, Matt Chatham, who used to play for the Patriots and won a few Super Bowls with them. And he was the one that kind of brought it to light that it looked like Joyner tried to turn his body, like, to his back to try to avoid the hit. And then my problem with the slide is, when you slide feet first, you're basically exposing your upper body.
Your head.
Yeah, and your head to the defender, unless you put your legs up, which then looks dirty on the quarterback side.
Right.
So I actually always felt comfortable going head first, because not only do you get the advantage in yardage, right? Especially if you're, you know, 6'4", right? You're getting an extra yard out of it, but also the fact that you could duck under guys and you could try to make a guy miss.
That's not giving yourself up, though, if you're diamond head first.
It's not, and that's why I said I didn't like the slide so much, unless it was, you know, blatantly obvious that I was going to get blown up, I was in a bad spot. I would try to go head first, because that way I could at least control when a player's coming to hit me or barreling down. I could have him help avoid my head. Now, in saying that, there was two separate instances where I got kneed in the back of the head and hit in the back of the head doing that. So I don't necessarily know if that's the best strategy.
Yeah, Mike Zimmer pretty much made it so that he blamed that on Greg Williams. And whether you can blame that on Greg Williams or not, Pat, Greg Williams, that kind of thing will follow him around after what happened in New Orleans the rest of his career. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, it's like connecting Greg Hardy's sideline behavior to his past domestic violence. I don't do those things. I am not connecting that player's decision to hit Teddy with the coach. I don't think that coach, look, these players are so transient nowadays. They're on teams for a year, 2 years. Somebody would be talking about, yeah, I was with Williams last year. You wouldn't believe the stuff he still tells us to do. I don't think it goes on like that. Often I don't defend the quarterback who gets hit in the slide, because I think they try to slide too late. and they try to get one extra yard before they start the site. I thought Teddy was reasonable. He was going down. He was happy with what he got, and he wasn't looking for more. That's why I was kind of on this occasion on his side. But I'm not connecting this to Greg Williams. That's just too easy to do every time for the rest of his life, and I'm not doing it.
I would agree with you, but I love the way that Mike Zimmer responds. And I've known Mike for a long time.
He is feisty.
Mike's the only guy that uses more curse words in a sentence than I do. And so Mike can, and that hurt Mike over his career in interviews. He was honest. He was, you know, truthful. Owners don't always want to hear what's true. You know, they want to hear what they want to hear. So how, Brady, as a player, if your coach does that after a game, do you respond to that? Do guys in the locker room love seeing that?
Yeah, because he's fighting for his players.
Right.
I mean, I'm talking about the fact that, you know, Joyner might not have even been intending to hurt Teddy Bridgewater. It might not have even been a dirty play. He was just, you know, trying to make a play in the moment and kind of got caught up in it. Yet he's still at his player's defense, right or wrong. And you've got to love that. It's kind of like the parent who looks out for their children when they're out, you know, caught underage drinking. But, you know, they're the ones that are still, you know, trying to protect their children, trying to do the right thing, you know, to look out for them. And that's essentially what he's doing. I'm a huge fan. I always have been of Mike Zimmer, not only from a scheme standpoint, but just the way he's really always taken care of his defensive players over the course of his career.
If he doesn't say anything, and I'm sure you've played for a coach, or Pat, you've had a coach, if the coach is kind of like just milquetoast and standing in the middle and doesn't say anything, does the team also look at that and say, hey, why isn't this guy taking up for our guy?
Yeah, it makes it seem like he doesn't care.
You ever had a coach like that?
I don't know if I've been in a position where I haven't seen a coach kind of react. Now, maybe not to that extent where they've, you know, outwardly reacted or said something after the game, but I've always had coaches that I think have done their best to stick up for players and really try to show emotion too when they felt like something was dirty or something wasn't done right.
How about you, Pat? You ever been involved with a coach?
I've had to counsel a coach or two about what to say. I said, they're going to stick a mic in your face and you're going to have a response. And so what do you think is the truth? Let's start there. And usually we get somewhere to the point of saying, as a club, we don't condone that. Yet we support our player because we know he's better than that. And so this time it happened, he was fined or penalized, and we understand that. But go look at his full body of work. The guy's been a terrific player. He doesn't have a long history of this kind of stuff. So shed light on it and admit, and you know, that you gotta be somewhat reasonable in your response. Now, everyone wants complete action from the, oh yeah, we're getting rid of the player, or you guys are wrong, or whatever. I just think you got to find a middle ground. If you're going to deal with the media every day, don't condone what it was, but make sure they understand what you think of the player as a person and move on.
All right, we've discussed Greg Hardy at times on this podcast, and to a man, we all think what he did is as disgusting as any human being can do to somebody else, okay? It's gross, disgusting, vile. And last week, the pictures came to light. Now, the NFL had seen the pictures. I had talked to some people that in the NFL that years, months ago, that said they saw the pictures. But I asked this question. Should the Dallas Cowboys allow him to play on the football field right now, as is, knowing what they know?
You know, I have contacts. I did talk to people in Dallas yesterday a lot. This was a text message I got back from someone way up the ladder. Pat, we're not privy to what he did through league or at Carolina while he was suspended. His agent has had him in counseling. We have also given him access to our infrastructure. And we feel like he's making progress. Okay. They did not see them. Now, I don't know that I would have signed him without seeing him. But how do you find him and how do you see him? Now that he's there, and Jerry, I think Jerry has put too much fuel on the fire, right? It's one thing to say we don't condone it, or I would have said simply his behavior on that sideline thing had nothing to do with his domestic violence and you guys shouldn't connect him. I would have said that. He didn't say that. He played offense instead of defense. He went right to he's one of our leaders and we'd like to do a contract extension. Those are the two things that got Dallas in trouble. The club called Dallas. But there are a lot of people to blame here. And there's a lot of things that can go around. First off, to me, this is one of the big examples of why the commissioner should have the power over discipline. because he gave him a 10-game suspension after sending him home for a year with full pay. And then the appeal process, which in my mind puts the union under the spotlight. Why are you defending that? Bill Cowher said it best yesterday. He said, look, it might have been the union's job to say, you know what, Greg? You're lucky it's 10 games. Go home, take your 10 games, and shut up. We shouldn't appeal this one. They didn't do that because their real agenda is to take away from Roger Goodell his power. And this was another example of them getting the ability to take a shot at him in court. And so I think sometimes there's a real good time to do that. And in the case of Greg, they shouldn't have done it. So I put some blame on them. I certainly put some blame on the guys who reduced it to 4 games. Harold Henderson. And I don't blame the young lady for not showing up. Because she's taking care of herself. But if the cause of domestic violence is as critical as it is, and we all think it is, I'll ask it as a question. Was it her duty to be there to help stop this problem in America?
I personally don't think it was her duty to. I don't ever even want to get into the conversation of trying to blame the victim or even draw any attention to the victim in any way.
No.
I think this is a societal thing and a problem with some of our institutions, and one not handling the case better. And in her specific case, you never know, Pat, if there are attorneys that were like, you know, based on the information that we have and all this kind of stuff, we don't know that if we could win this by jury. So maybe it would be better to settle in that particular case. So you never know all that goes into these sorts of deals.
I agree.
But I do think you bring up an interesting point, though, because we're talking about the power that Roger Goodell has to, I guess, provide punishment for a player for his off-the-field activities. And there's a guy named Clay Travis who started the website Outkick Coverage and all that. And he actually brought that to my attention, that he didn't believe that Roger Goodell should be in that position in the first place, and that we should draw – that actually this whole issue is – where everyone's looking at Jerry Jones, everyone's looking at Greg Hardy, and instead we should be looking at the legal systems in North Carolina, in New Jersey, where these incidents took place, and we should be harder on them on the fact
Correct.
That how could these photos be part of evidence, and then you couldn't come up with a conviction, or you allow an individual to not only get away in an appeal, but also to have it expunged from his record, where technically, and Pat, tell me if I'm wrong here, or Pete, if you know this too, where now if he was actually convicted for a second time for this, it would really be his first conviction.
Well, he was convicted. It was guilty the first time.
He was convicted, but he won an appeal, but then he was expunged.
It's
removed off his record altogether.
That's disgraceful.
It is. It's awful.
So we do have two systems, the Jersey group and the Carolina group, that put the league in a very awkward position. But I will say this. I was doing a radio show every day of the week from March. I think March 14th was the day Greg signed in Dallas. I can tell you, I did not get more than 5 protest phone calls over the month period following his signing from people who were outraged by it. Mostly it was Dallas fans saying how excited they were they got a pass rusher. And so we have to look at society in a bigger scope. Have we put ourselves in a position that we value winning football games to the point where anything goes? Because it felt like that in the whole month of March.
Pat, one of the most interesting things I read was a quote from Ray Rice. He was interviewed on SportsCenter on ESPN by Hannah Storm. And she at first kind of asked him, and he kind of gave an apology and talked about what he'd been doing since. But at the end of their discussion, he made this comment saying how, for the rest of his life, you know, he had always thought that he wanted to be that person where people would say, grow up and say, hey, I want my kid to be just like Ray Rice. Whereas now, he admitted in saying that people grow up telling their kids to not be like Ray Rice. And Greg Hardy's in that same position. And that to me, that comment and that way of looking at it's a bit thought-provoking, only in the sense that the Dallas Cowboys fans are more excited about their pass rush than they are about this guy being in a position and a platform to be a role model for kids.
But
it shows all these talented young high school football players or junior high football players in Texas that you can get away with some this type of stuff off the field and eventually not only be a Dallas Cowboy, but possibly be a long-term deal and have a guy like Jerry Jones call you a leader.
Don't we also have some union issues here too, Pat? You mentioned it, but if the Dallas Cowboys suddenly said, we don't want Greg Hardy on our team, he's not playing, they cut him. And 31 other teams get together and they say, we don't want Greg Hardy on our team, and they don't sign him. Isn't there a collusion issue now involved there? Because unlike Ray Rice, who was at the end of his career and his numbers were 3.7 per
You carry, say he's at the end, though. The teams determined that.
But it was easier to say Ray Rice wasn't going to get a second chance because of his ability, whereas with Greg Hardy, it would be not for his ability specifically. And well, and technically, by the law, he was not guilty, whatever, however you want to say it, right, of this crime, which is why he didn't serve any jail time or punishment, and now it's left, like you said, Pat, onto the league. I'm just playing devil's advocate here because I think what he did is repulsive, and he should be off the team.
Number one, at no time did I believe Ray Rice was done. Number two, since the start of the season, the amount of running backs who've been signed because of injuries and he hasn't gotten a workout is embarrassing. If you want to talk about measuring his talent against the rank and file running backs that are out there. Number three, compared to Greg Hardy, I think you would have gotten a spokesman and a guy and an advocate for the right way to do things from Ray Rice. I've known Ray since his high school days. Ray's made a mistake, but he's a good person, I think. And he's had domestic violence groups supporting him now. He can't even get a workout. But I promise you this about Greg Hardy. He wasn't on anyone's on every team's board to be signed because he could rush the press. There are actually teams out there that say, no, we're going to try to win without this guy.
Which is what you should do. I'm sorry. I mean, I was one of those guys initially. I thought, okay, we don't know the specifics of the case. But like the Ray Rice situation, when the video came out, that had such a... But you see the pictures last week. I mean, it was just, to me, it turned your stomach. It's one of those things...
The problem is, why did it take the pictures? If anyone read it, read his file or looked at it, you know, they should have known this. And Pat, tell me this much. Jerry Jones didn't see the pictures? That's BS. Look, he didn't do his job then in vetting Greg Hardy in the first place. You're telling me Deadspin can find access to getting these photos, and a billionaire and Jerry Jones can't?
Well, I'm confident he didn't see them, but I'm on your side on that, Brady, in the sense of two questions. Did you need to see them? Number one, and I don't think you needed to see them, because if you read the whole thing, first of all, there were a lot of drugs involved during the whole evening. The whole shooting match had a lot of bad things going on with it. And number two, you could make a decision now if you are so inclined. But Jerry's point to the public has been, I decided to give him a second chance, and you're not showing me anything that's new. You're showing me the stuff that got him thrown out for a year with full pay and then a 10-game suspension, which was reduced. That's all you're showing me is the stuff that led to those two things. I'm here to give him a second chance. He can stick by that. I would have never done it, and I think a lot of GMs, owners, coaches wouldn't do it. I've seen owners' wives get players taken off rosters for things similar to this. And Jerry's daughter's on the domestic violence committee.
Yeah, and Bob Kraft's late wife, Myra, used to always get guys booted off the team for
She things. Got Christian Peter thrown off that team.
Yep, absolutely. I mean,
the day after the draft.
Yeah, that used to happen. We'll move on from that, but we all pretty much are solid ground on the same. We agree on that thing. Get him out of there. He shouldn't be on the field. All right, let's move to another thing that was near and dear to me is the change in offense in Indianapolis. I've been a vocal critic of Pep Hamilton at Indianapolis, and I'm a big believer in, and I've actually talked to him about this. When he got there, he was talking about how he's going to run Stanford's offense. I said, look, you have Andrew Luck in the National Football League. You don't run Stanford's offense in the NFL, okay? You just don't. You don't make that guy become something he could succeed in it, but why would you do that when you have that talent? So they make a change. They go to Rob Chudzinski. They ran crossing routes yesterday, which weren't in Pep Hamilton's offense. They ran rub routes. They made things easier, and yet they still ran the football. They ran the ball as much as they threw the football. I think it was much more comfortable for Andrew Luck against the good Denver defense than he was at any point this season.
I was with Rob Chudzinski. He was my OC in 2007-2008. He is a fantastic offensive mind and really should have been given a longer shot at head coach when he was with the Cleveland Browns. There, it's seldom you're going to find a guy who works harder. I mean, the guy literally sleeps at the facility. I mean, that during the season, that's his home. He tells him, you're going to send me something?
Go home, Rob.
Hey, look, that's what he chooses to do. You choose to live your life. But all I know is he's one of the best offensive minds. I've never seen a guy who shows, I mean, he digs through some film now. I mean, 3 years back, he would dig through and find a bunch formation that worked when set up this certain way that would work in a particular game. We actually played Jacksonville. I forget, it was 2008. And it was just how he had gone back and looked at it on film. And we ended up using a bunch formation to get a guy wide open. I mean, you could have punted the ball to him down in the red zone, which is saying a lot. And that's what he incorporates. He gets easy completions. He gets the ball out of your hand. He can help solve protection issues. You talked about the rub routes, the crossing routes, some of the pick plays and all that. He gets it. He's a great offensive mind. He can really help quarterbacks excel. I mean, and you know, for me personally, I mean, I just wish I would have had another opportunity to work with him because he was so you know, pivotal in my career, at least helped me early on understand the NFL game and understand a different system. I really think Andrew Luck is going to take off. Not only the rest of this season, but if Rob doesn't end up taking a head coaching job somewhere else, like the University of Miami, if they call him back down there, which would be a mistake on Miami's part if they don't hire him, if there's an opportunity, or another NFL team doesn't hire him as their head coach. Because he, to me, is one of the best guys who's not in that position yet. And Pat, you tell me if you think otherwise.
I do not think otherwise. A couple things. As you were talking and describing the merits of Chud, it reminded me how ridiculous Cleveland was. And there's another guy they let out the door. Just felt like I had to say that. Number two, I think he's been the first choice of Pagano this whole time. I think he wanted him to be the coordinator, and I think that I don't know that Pagano had full say on how that worked. Anyway, it's all cleaned up now for the short term because I think they're going to give Pagano whatever he needs. Now, if I'm Jim Irsay, thank God I'm not. If I'm sitting there watching last night in 1 week, I've watched an almost remarkable recovery of offensive strategy and offensive production to the point where I should go down to the locker room, go into Pagano's office, close the door, and apologize. And he won't do that. So they're destined to do something really dumb at the end of the year. But to me, you got a glimpse last night of what it can be for the long haul. And then I'd give Chudzinski such a big raise that he wouldn't want to go to Miami.
Well, Pat, Chudzinski was the guy Pagano wanted from the start, and yeah. Pep Hamilton was the guy Ryan Grigson rammed down his throat.
Right, and that's why last night cleared up for me who should be standing at the end of this.
But will any of them be standing at the end of it? Barring a Super Bowl victory or a Super Bowl appearance, will anybody in Indianapolis be standing after this?
Well, it'll be a shame if Pagano's not, but I have
agree.
A feeling he won't be. And that'll be so sad that they'll let that happen. The one thing I can say about the Colt players, they play hard for the guy.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of coaches out there that guys don't play hard for. And he may still win the division, most likely will win the division. So you're going to get a guy that went to the championship game last year, finally got the coordinator he wanted, is going to win the division. And your brilliant mind as an owner is going to lead you to, I need a different guy.
It's incredible to think about that too, Pat, and you bring up that team playing for him. It's seldom you see players play for coaches because it's seldom that there's coaches that can tap into the emotional side of players. We talked about before coaches who are inspiring, who motivate. Chuck Pagano's on a different level, you know, because I think of everything he's battled through and everything that team has battled through with him. They're probably in part the reason why he's able to fight through and come back and be healthy and all that. And I think it would be an incredible mistake if they got rid of him. Some team's going to end up then hiring him because to be able to tap into that emotional part of any team and of any culture is incredibly difficult. And he's clearly done that.
One thing I wanted to ask you, because I went back and when I studied all of Luck's throws this year, it just the scheme looked he was miscast in it to me. I mean, particularly with what he has around them, the offensive line, the deep vertical passing wasn't cohesive to having a bad offensive line, and it just looked miscast. How important is it for the quarterback? Because he's had success with that offense in the past, and so everybody's coming down on me saying, hey, his scheme wasn't a problem the first 3 years. How important is it to feel comfortable with the scheme? I mean, he's been in it, so he should be, but with what's going on within the scheme.
Yeah, but to me, it's been a different issue. I mean, they say, oh, he's dealt with protection issues, you know, the whole
time.
Not
like this.
Not like this. It hasn't been this bad. And to deal with not having a running game for this long and then being banged up, right, which you got to love about the guy. He's probably got broken ribs, doesn't want to tell anyone about it, and is dealing with whatever that is on the side. So I think those things are a bit more factors. I personally think they haven't been utilizing the talent that they have the right way, right? And Rob Chudzinski will know how to utilize that. Like, they were putting Andre Johnson in the slot at some points in time, which is fine every once in a while, but look, this is what you do. You get T.Y. Hilton, you get Philip Dorsett, fast guys, or even Moncrief, and you put those guys in your crossing routes and your rub routes and all that because you want to get these smaller wide receivers who are fast guys the ball quickly and in space, just like you would a wide receiver screen. You really want to do that with some of those downfield short crossing routes. Then you all of a sudden get them in space where they're, you know, it's a catch and run ball, and then they can really hurt you because your window of opportunity to hit one of those guys down the field isn't as good if it's tight coverage, right? If they're wide open, that's different. But it's the NFL. It's seldom that you see a wide receiver be able to run just scot-free wide open downfield. Usually there's a guy on him right at his hip. If it's Andre Johnson, he's a bigger target. He can use his body. He can elevate and go up and get it. So I personally think they weren't using those guys in the proper manner. Chud's now doing that, just watching their one game under his belt calling plays.
He also got the tight ends involved. And I mean, you have all before the season, all we heard was they had Fleener, they have Allen, now they have Jack Doyle, who's actually a decent player too. And they got 11 targets to the tight ends yesterday, which I think is, Pat, I think that's a step in the right direction.
Shud's a former tight end.
Yeah, well, he knows. He knows how to diversify the attack. Back to Brady's first point, though, when you have all those little speedsters and any one or two of those tight ends, the way to use Andre, in my opinion, you shoot a hole in this Brady's, he's on the single side, and the other guys are making a bunch on the other side. And I'm going to force you to roll to the bunch, or I'm going to play pitch and catch with the bunch until you give me Andre alone and singled up on the other side. I'm just going to play that game. It's not that hard. But to start thinking you're going to have him do a Z shallow cross, come on.
Yeah, the design was bad. I mean,
the door of hope is wide open here. They just beat the Broncos. Stop making believe we've got to change everything. If you want to tell the GM to take a walk at the end of the year, great. But this Pagano, if you let him go, he's going to be the head coach of the NFL next year at another place, and you're going to be kicking yourself for letting that happen.
And let me say this, as far as the scheme goes, and what they're running at Stanford or what Pep Hamilton was running, the terminology and the routes, right, they're not that drastically different, but the devil's in the details, right? Like the way Rob Chudzinski goes about coaching how to run specific routes or when to break it off or how to make an adjustment, that's what makes the difference between maybe what Pep Hamilton was doing and what he brought from Stanford and how Rob Chudzinski's going to do it, right? Maybe instead of just doing a straight stem, Rob Chudzinski says, off the snap of the ball, I want you to take an inside release and then get back vertical, right? Because I want you to force the leverage of the defender. It's something that people probably watch on television don't realize. But it's something that Rob Chudzinski adds into the scheme or adds into a route, and it makes a world of difference because it allows that wide receiver then to gain leverage and possibly gain an extra step, so he's that much more open for Andrew Luck to hit.
All right, go ahead, Pat.
I guess Brady, try to put yourself for us in Andrew Luck's shoes. Andrew Luck, you know, there was always this image of, well, he and Pep, they're all Stanford guys. That guy played last night like he was as excited as could be about where the offense was.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard whenever you're breaking up a quarterback and offensive coordinator because they spend so much time together in that relationship, right? But not only did he seem excited, Pat, to me what he seemed like was more confident. And I think it helped because they got off to such a fast start. And I really feel like this is the first time probably in his life that he's ever had to have people question whether or not they should have drafted him. I mean, this year, you heard people say that, and you're going, you're nuts.
Right.
But there's people out there who made that claim, and it's impossible not to hear it. And being banged up, not playing as well as he'd like to, he might have lost a little confidence in his abilities. And, you know, maybe it got to him a little bit. So I think not only getting off to a fast start, but just maybe something fresh, something new, something that is a changeup for him since his time at Stanford, maybe that's where some of that excitement came from.
All right. Situational coaching is, you know, it's my pet peeve. I want to run these by you and see how you guys think. The Green Bay Packers score to make it 37-20 with about 6.5 minutes, I think it was, to go in the game. What do you do on the conversion?
Oh, you know, I'm not a believer really in this. I don't like blanket statements, but I don't chase points. Like, it's too early. If you're thinking 2 points here, Pete.
Well, and Pat, he's not really chasing the points, but you're making a good point. He went for two. Why in the hell did he go for two? You make it because if you don't get it, it's 17, and you have to score two twos and two touchdowns, two twos, and another point.
Yeah, I'm not a believer in chasing them at that point in games. I think you go for them, and a lot of coaches have told me that they have the exact same point conversion chart in front of them that they had before the kick was moved back.
But no matter where the kick's from, you got a kick there. You give yourself a chance to stay in the game. If you don't get that, you're basically eliminating your chance of being in the game.
Right. I'm not chasing points at that point.
So they made it 16, and they would still need 2 and 2, right? So they made it 15. They went for 2 and made it 15.
Now I feel like you changed the narrative.
No. It was 17, 37-20.
Okay.
And they went for 2 to make it 37-22 to make it 15.
Okay.
They should have just kicked and made it 16.
Yeah.
Then when you score again, then you get your 2, then you get your 2.
Yeah, I have no idea. And that's actually something that I can't stand is when teams go for 2 too early, right? And you said 6 minutes left.
I got to go back and look at the exact number.
Either way, though. I mean,
you still, in that situation, you got to kick.
Yeah, no, you have to kick unless you don't feel confident who your field goal kicker or is if you struggle a little bit. Maybe in that particular game, or maybe there's something else going on that we don't know about, right? Maybe all of a sudden there's something wrong with the long snapper. I mean, you never know. Obviously, there's other decisions that go on that might force them to do something instead of something else.
Another situation at the end of the half. I don't know if you saw the Dolphins at the end of the half in the Dolphins game. He had a timeout in his pocket, and instead of kicking a field goal at the end of the half to make it, I think it would have been 17-10, I think, or something like that. Pat, you remember at the end of the half, Dan Campbell, he went for it on fourth down. The pass was incomplete. They got nothing.
Yeah, Buffalo had 19.
It was 19-7.
Right.
Instead of making it 19-10, he went for it. And they had the ball coming out of the first at the end of the second half. So they had a chance to gain some momentum. He didn't kick his field goal to get points on the last play, and then they didn't get anything. What's the right call there? He even admitted after the game.
Take the points.
Just kick the field goal.
Of course.
These aren't hard decisions. They're just tempting and teasing, and that's why guys – and he's clearly not listening to his guy upstairs. Everyone's got one. You just kicked the thing. You're at 19-10. You're getting the ball back. You got 30 minutes of football. What are you? Why are you putting yourself in that position? It's all great if you score the touchdown, but the field goes. You know, and most coaches are chalk bettors. They just bet on the odds, and the odds say the field goal is 100% success rate, and the touchdown is about 38-40%.
Yeah, I mean, and plus from a player's perspective, you like to carry some of that momentum.
Right.
I mean, you've got now 15, 20 minutes to think about it at halftime, and you're going, why the heck did we not kick a field goal? Because we get the ball back. We could easily close this gap in a hurry, but instead now we come away with no points, and we feel like we're dead. Now questioning the intelligence of our head coach and the decision that he just made.
Particularly on the road, right?
So yeah,
you get a field goal at the end of the half. You go in, you feel good about yourself. You take away a little momentum from the other team in the crowd.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they didn't have their smoothie.
What about this? Maybe they needed a smoothie and a good night's sleep. Maybe they needed a chip.
Oh, there you go. What about Danny Quinn taking the field goal?
I'm not surprised by that. Are you really surprised by that, though, Pat?
No, I'm not surprised at all. But he's been criticized a lot. And to me, okay, he's got 2 minutes and change on his side. He kicks it. He puts it within 1 point. He bets on his defense, and he puts himself in a position to win the game with a field goal.
No, I don't have any problem with that one.
Yeah, no, you're right, though, Pat.
Now, the media's been after him, and he had to stand there and justify that, which, you know, that's how
post. No, he played it the right way.
Yeah, it wasn't like they were a juggernaut that day on offense either, right? Like, Atlanta had 13 points up to that point.
It was fourth and what when he went for the field goal? It was fourth and
Was it two? Fourth and goal from the two or something like that?
Yeah, he played the right call.
Yeah, because and plus, like I said, the offense wasn't necessarily playing well, so it's not like you feel like you can rely on them. And on top of it, he's a defensive guy. What do you expect him to do? He wants to rely on his defense.
Get the ball back. Another field goal to win it. Yeah. The other one that bothered me, and this one was, we're all sitting here praising Chuck Pagano, but what the hell was he doing punting to the guy on the last play of the half? Kick the damn ball out of bounds. Am I wrong about that one? Well,
I had a Tom Coughlin flashback. Twice that I can remember, I've been able to read Coughlin's lips, and he told his punter, kick it out of bounds, followed by a kick that could be returned, followed by returns for touchdowns against the Giants, followed by him and reading his lips again, going, what the F did you just do? It looked just like that to me. I will say that the coach was mad but not rattled by it happening to him.
I'm just confused as a player, like, why Pat McAfee just doesn't punt it out of bounds on his own. Like,
Pat McAfee's been around the league for 8,000 years.
And then he just kind of can turn and look and be like, oh, sorry, miscommunication, or I shanked it, or, you know, something.
Right.
But you would think that for his own personal statistics, too, he'd be looking out for himself, just punt out of bounds.
See, that one bothered me as much, because you know what? It gave Denver momentum. They were skating. And that game, remember, they were done. It was 17-0, and they made it 17-7? That was a bad, bad decision by Chuck Pagano. Here's another one at the end. I don't know if you guys noticed this. This is just a minor pet peeve of mine, but there were 2 seconds left in the game last Sunday night, and both teams were tied. They're ready to go to overtime, and they kicked off to Josh Huff, and he downed the ball in the end zone. Am I wrong? You got to take a chance and rip that thing. That's the, right?
Exactly. The only reason you're down the ball is because they already told you we're going to take a knee and get out of here.
Yeah, but the only thing you can do is there's 2 seconds left. If you fumble, they recover it. They're not going to, the game's over, unless it pops into somebody's hand and he goes the other way. And you're more apt to rip a kick than fumble one and go into somebody's hands and go the other way.
I think you made fun of me before for saying that if it's before half and there's 2 seconds left and you just downed it like that, I would still run like a running play. I mean, you never know. Maybe
no,
it pops.
No,
see,
no.
And you say no.
No.
But here's the thing is, what's the downside to it? All of a sudden, you fumble the handoff, they run it back for a touchdown, which is probably the same percentage of chances of that happening with a kickoff.
You don't remember.
But even then, you have the whole half of football
to come back. But this is at the end of the game, and the game's tied. All you can do is rip the kick, and you win.
But I mean, Pete, let me ask you, now I got to at least investigate this. If you're willing to take the kick out of the end zone on a return – and risk a fumble that could be picked up or whatever. And if you want to do that, then why wouldn't you follow Brady's idea, down it and go out and run the ball? It's all you've done is taken the kick return to the 20-yard line and start from there.
Well, because you got a better chance to get a crack in a crease to open up a kick return than you do to rip off an 80-yard run, don't you?
Do you?
Yeah.
See, in your opinion, but I'm saying I think there's a better chance. Okay, what do you practice more during the week, kickoff returns or offensive plays?
Offensive plays.
Okay, so I would think that preparation would be on the side of a team being able to run the football for an 80-yard touchdown over a kick return.
Wouldn't you agree a lot of kickoff returns are accidents where a guy gets out of his lane and he's trying to be a hero and he gets out of
it? You could say the same thing about an 80-yard touchdown run.
Yeah, I disagree. I think you should have ripped the kick.
I just think you can't have it both ways. That's my only
point. No, but he's talking about the end of the half. Brady's talking about the end of the half anyway.
Hey, with 2 seconds, I might throw a Hail Mary and just try for the interference goal. The best play in football is the official on your side.
Yeah. Yeah. In particular, when you're talking about the Dallas Cowboys.
Not deep in your own end, though. Not deep. You try and rip the kick.
It's 2 seconds. The ball's going to be in and fight, so all you're risking is them returning an interception.
Or they knock it out of your quarterback's hands and scoop it up.
Oh, he's a realist, Pat. You can't convince him otherwise.
No, I'm a situational freak. I am. It bothers me to watch these guys botch it week in and week out. They make millions, and they botch it week in and week out.
Well, now there's your problem, Pete. You're a little jealous of that cash.
Well, yeah. Aren't we all, right?
Of course.
All right. Change in quarterback in San Francisco. Colin Kaepernick out. Blaine Gabbert in. Does some decent things. And if Jerome Simpson could have held the ball, he would have been even better. Is this the end of Colin Kaepernick? in San Francisco?
I think it is, not because he doesn't have the talent to be the quarterback, because I think Gabbert will start to fail. I mean, he's Blaine Gabbert. You get three games of tape of him, and then his life can get pretty ugly, and they're not a great team. But I just think how Kaepernick's handling himself is probably why he's got to go. I watched him on the sideline yesterday. They had a camera on him a lot of the time. I'm sure you noticed it, but hardly a player on the team was making eye contact with him, and he didn't even have his earpiece in. Brady, you're the backup quarterback, and you may not like that job, but that's your job today. And I looked, and he had his earpiece out most of the time. He wasn't even listening.
Yeah, that's pretty discouraging, just from an overall leadership standpoint. For a guy who's been the face of that franchise now for a number of years, that makes it seem like you're not only just upset and disturbed, you're giving up on your teammates and the guys who've battled with you through the good and bad.
If I'm not starting, I'm departing.
Yeah, but that's not how you play it, man. And there's other people who see that. There's other organizations who look at him and say,
that's the thing. It's like everything you do is a job interview.
Yeah, that's what they tell you. I mean, look, that's the biggest catch too when you're like a banged up player trying to play, is everyone else in the world is like, oh yeah, you got to fight through, you got to be tough, you got to go play. But the second you go out there, and if you're 100%, you're not 100%, and you're not as effective at 90 or 85%, all of a sudden there's a GM or there's a front office somewhere who's saying, well, look at this stretch, well, look at this. Or you go back to renegotiate with your own team, well, you played bad in this particular game. I mean, I remember breaking my right index finger, practicing like crap my second year in the league, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. I needed to put pins in, but I was like, no, I'll tough it out. I'll try to go, and I'll figure out a way of working through it. Played terrible the next game versus the Texans. Played terrible. And they ended up, taking him out of halftime. They're like, and I looked at him, I'm like, well, what do you expect? You saw this all week. I couldn't spin the football because I literally couldn't control the top of my right index finger because the bone was shattered.
And you didn't tell anybody?
No, they knew.
They knew. Did anybody that was it on?
No,
the
we didn't.
Report?
We didn't tell it. Well,
there's your problem.
I'm not going to get into that.
There's
I don't know if
your
it was on the
problem
report.
Right there. You guys, hey, it should be on the injury report.
Well, no, they probably put on the injury report, but it doesn't tell the severity of it or however right. They put it.
That
has nothing to do
finger.
With it. It doesn't have to do
yeah,
with that.
It does. That's because I think a lot of times the injury report hangs players out to dry. I'll be honest with you.
Okay, that's a whole different separate subject. We're getting away from what we initially were trying to talk about.
Life bring you into a different world sometimes.
Oh, I mean, my gosh. Pat, can you get over here
quick?
Yeah,
let's go back to Kaepernick. Here's why, and this is what I would have said to him today. Hey, I noticed you weren't really with your earpiece in. I would have shown the video. Here you are walking around. That's not what I define as being the backup quarterback, which is what you were. But above and beyond me in this club, how about if you had to play and you weren't tuned in, and all of a sudden there was a sudden change and you had to go out there, would you be able to go back out and prove why we were wrong and why you're the best quarterback?
Well, no. He had to go in. He did have to go
at
in.
At the very end.
Remember Gabbert got knocked out for a couple plays, knocked out. Remember he got hit. Gabbert didn't want to come out of the game, and they had to put Gabbert in.
Gabbert had to go in.
And he, well, and he,
you know, it wasn't what I was trying to paint to him if I was talking to him is, look, you're going to get another shot, but if you're operating this way, you're not getting better. And as the number two, this is part of your job description. And I just think his immaturity level started to surface, and maybe why he got benched was becoming clearer to me. And I heard all the stories about in the hallways with the headphones on and not saying anything to anybody and trying to acknowledge nothing in the building like he was in his own world. All this nonsense. It's just a maturity thing. He's got to go. That was your question. That's my answer.
But is it? Can it be a case of he's just a shy kid? And can you be a quarterback in the National Football League if you're a shy, introverted kid?
Teddy Bridgewater's shy and more introverted.
Yeah, he's a little more of an extrovert than you think he is, though.
No, I know him. I'm just saying, for a young man that I've worked out with before and all that, he it's not like he's like very boisterous or when we're going out and throwing routes together. It wouldn't be like he would be, it's like half the time I'd be like, yeah, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, and he would just kind of go along with
it. But Teddy will be in the middle of a group of guys, whereas Colin Kaepernick tended to, the stories are that he tended to be by himself all the time.
I think that may have been a more image thing. I don't know him. I can't really speak on that. I'm just saying that I think a shy guy can you know, go ahead and lead, and he can lead by example. He can do all those things. I don't think you have to be
hanging out with everybody on a consistent basis. Or
you could do that. Look, okay, I wonder, and I don't know this, it's just a question. I wonder how often Philip Rivers gets to hang out with everyone. He's got, what, 8 kids?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to be with his family. Right. I mean, look, this is
an And then you get older and your life changes and you're not hanging out with young guys that go out and stuff and everything. Yeah, I mean, that's life gets in the way sometimes of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, but even then, it might just not be who he is anyways, or he doesn't want to put himself in that position.
But in the locker room hanging out, I'm talking about.
Yeah,
you know, you know what I mean? There's difference. It's one thing going out with somebody, but hanging out in the locker room and being in the middle of the cutting up and all that stuff.
Well, I've interviewed him face to face. He has some issues, and he's got some unique perspective on things. And I would never put him in a category with Teddy Bridgewater. I don't even think they're close to having the same form of operations. I do know Jeep Christ very well, and I've known him for 25 years. He's the one of the easiest guys in the world to get along with. For him and them to come to the conclusion that we got to switch quarterbacks had more to do, I think, with his presence in the building, around the facility, the leadership end of it, than his production. They're not a very good team. But for them to think Blaine Gabbert's the guy had as much to do with, I can't stand looking at this kid anymore, the way he's thinking and operating.
Yeah, look, I'm not trying to draw a comparison between Colin Kaepernick and Teddy Bridgewater, Pat. I'm just trying to say...
I thought you were pretty clear that they weren't the same.
Yeah, no, they're not. I guess I was just trying to make the case that, like, Teddy, to me, seems to be a little bit more shy, more reserved. And
more reserved than more reserved, some other quarterbacks, yeah.
Yeah, than some other quarterbacks I've been around. And again, I haven't been around Colin Kaepernick, so I don't know. But obviously it works in Teddy Bridgewater's case, to kind of the question I guess you had asked, Pete, initially.
All right, before we get out of here, we got a couple, one huge game this week in the NFC West, I think, in Seattle and Arizona. To me, this is a perfect proving ground for Arizona. You know, we heard all that talk last year, Pat, and you're around Seattle a lot, you know those guys, and I'm sure it just infuriates them to even hear it when they say, oh, if Carson Palmer hadn't gone down, they would have won the division. If Carson Palmer was healthy, Arizona would have won the division. We might think that, but it's one thing to think it and then another thing to do it. What do your Seattle people say about that?
Well, Pete coached Carson. He knows how good Carson is. He has great respect for him, and he understands that they have multiple receivers. And they have enough receivers to break down cover three if you can get them the time to throw it, right? It's pretty hard to keep playing three deep when you have John Brown and Michael Floyd and Fitz. So he has great respect for what they can do to you. But on the other side of that coin is they have their style, and they're going to, you know, the thing I love about Arizona is they play big nickel all the time with three safeties, but that may not be the way to go against a team that wants to bring in a 270-pound fullback and pound living crap out of you. So it's an interesting matchup.
I think it's an interesting matchup because, one, it'll be an indication of whether or not it truly is a changing of the guards for the NFC West and if Arizona can actually be on top of the division. But also, you know, Pete, you and I disagree with the strategy in which they should implement.
100%.
Because, and I'll lay out mine and then you can have a chance to tell yours. But I think you look at the teams that are most competitive and have success versus the Seattle Seahawks, it's the teams that can run the football and stay balanced. And even though that's not necessarily what you believe to be the identity of the Arizona Cardinals, I still think they're a physical team who Bruce Arians wants to be balanced. They want to be able to run the football with Chris Johnson or David Johnson. And I think utilizing those guys versus lesser coverage guys and like K.J. Wright and the likes, the linebacker, I think that's where they could probably win. Now, Bobby Wagner's not a mismatch. He's great as far as in pass coverage and man-to-man. But, you know, K.J. Wright, some of those guys, maybe not so much.
K.J. Wright's had a really good
year. He has had a really good year, but, you know, he's not Jamie Collins. No. So I think you still got to be able to run the ball, and you got to be able to go there and do it. And then you can try to utilize, John Brown, you know, Michael Floyd, Larry Fitzgerald. You can then bring those guys into the game plan. But, you know, you look at Carolina, how they get it done. They didn't need to throw the football around all of a sudden because they feel like that's their blueprint, right? You go back and look at the New England Patriots, who are the epitome of a team that from week to week just does whatever they have to do to win. And there may be a different in this case, but because they spread the football out and then they basically worked that triangle, that inside box. But they also were able to run the football as well. So I think they still have to be able to run the football. They still have to start there, and then they can work their way into the passing game where some things may open up.
See, we agree. We disagree. I'm the complete opposite of that, and here's why. When you watch them against Cincinnati in the game at Cincinnati, when they went up tempo, spread them out, threw the ball, got them in coverage, they won the game and dictated tempo. And they had to do it, and they did it the right way. Even against Carolina. Carolina did very little on offense until the fourth quarter when they were behind and Cam Newton started throwing the football around. Detroit, the game where Calvin Johnson fumbled, the last drive, they did nothing. They tried to run the ball up there. They dictated tempo. The Seattle dictated tempo to them. They couldn't do anything, and then they had to throw it. The end of the game went boom, 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 right down the field. Calvin Johnson fumbled, remember, into the end zone. I think if you go there with the mentality of I'm going to run the football, they're going to start taking that away because they're hard to run on. They're going to take that away from you, and then you're going to be caught in a situation where those pass rushers are turned loose on third down, and they're dictating tempo to you, and you have problems.
They're going to be turned loose on third down if you have an incompletion on first down.
I get that.
And you're
that.
In second and 10, because then you're trying to get half back.
Then you throw on second down.
Look, you're going against the Legion of Boom. I think that's an uphill battle.
But I think getting Cam Chancellor in coverage, I think the other corner, Kerry Williams, is average at best. So there are ways to go after them. And to me, I think that's what Arizona has to do. And then, you know, to your point about the running game, yeah, they went out and got Yapati to play left guard. They drafted Cooper's playing right guard pretty well this year. They're a better offensive line, and they want to run the ball, but run off your throw. In other words, you dictate tempo and then come back and run the football that way.
I don't know if I see it working. And another thing is, you're talking about this up-tempo offense or how Cincinnati won it in Cincinnati, right? That's hard to do on the road if you're not Carolina played
at Seattle.
Yeah, but
and won in the fourth quarter by throwing the football.
First off, but that wasn't what got them to that point. They also remained balanced and they were able to rush a little bit as well. And they basically won on a play that was a botched coverage in the secondary. So,
but he had drove them twice in the fourth quarter.
Okay, we'll agree to disagree, so we can just move on. But anyways, the point that I'm trying to make to you is when you try to run that up tempo stuff, if it doesn't work early and all of a sudden you get down, now you're really in a bad position. So you can try to run that up-tempo crap when you go into Seattle, right? But if you don't have success with the first couple drives and Seattle's able to get points on the board and all of a sudden put you in a position where you have to throw to come back, now you're defeating your whole game plan.
What happens if you run the ball in the first two series and you go three and out?
You're taking time off the clock. Your defense gets a little more rest. You have an opportunity to say it doesn't matter.
Well, let me throw one curve the other way, though. Arizona has two losses, and their two losses were the two games they gave up the most rushing yards. They lost to St. Louis. They lost to Pittsburgh. They gave up 164 and 141. To me, that's what Pete Carroll's looking at. That's what they're looking. You know what? We are a run team. We believe in a run. We're gonna give Marshawn 20, and we're going to give all those other guys 15 between them. And there's nothing in those reports that indicates they should try to do more than that. That's why I think when it comes right down to it, and Brady's the advocate for the running game from Arizona, I'm just looking at it from the other side going, Pete is going to look, and his coaches are going to say, Bevel's going to go, good, we're committing ourselves to 40 run plays against these guys. We're going to get them out of big nickel, or they're going to live and die in it because we're going to be able to get a physical mismatch somewhere. Because at the end, it's Tyrann Mathieu. They finagle him into the pressure, you know, into the box stuff too much. They'll be very happy to try to block him. So I don't think this is a high-scoring game. I don't think you guys probably do either.
No.
I think Russell gets sacked three times because he always does. At the end of the day, can they get to Carson? Because if they don't, they'll lose to him. But I just think they're going to come out and you're going to see a heavy dose of running. The last one to you, Braids, is up-speed, up-tempo offense. I've seen a lot of guys BS me about doing that. They get to Seattle, they can't do it.
Yeah. You know what happens is they practice it all week, and then when they have to go into an environment like that, they get scared because they know what the result is. You get down, you get playing from behind. Guess who the blame goes on?
Bruce Arians won't get scared.
Well,
you know what happens if Pete runs a 10-play drive and Marshawn Lynch runs the ball five times, banging him backers, you go out in a hurry up to counter that touchdown, and you're three and out and use 16 seconds of play clock.
Yeah.
Well, what about going down and getting, you know, a 10-0 lead and try and take them out of what they want to do. That's the other side of it. You know they want to run the ball. If they get behind, they're going to have to change and turn
not,
to
not, they're not early in the game. They've proven Daryl Bevel's one of the best OCs sticking with it.
They will run the ball down 10 points like it's nothing.
Well, I'll look at the first two series and say Arizona's dead in this game or they have a chance. That's, I can tell usually in a game.
Yeah, based off your game plan for them,
yeah,
of course.
Well, yeah, I'm the coach.
Well,
I'm the coach. The thing is, 9 times out of 10, Bruce Arians thinks a lot like I do as the way he plays the game.
Gosh, here we go, Pat. Save me. Can this podcast end for today?
It's ending.
We're going to end the show on that note.
All right, Pat.
Arians, that's today's
All right, guys, it was a good one. We'll wrap it up.